All right, the time is 8:09. That is She Had and Pacifier, and that's some classic Kiwi rock. For some classic Kiwis, we're speaking to Annie Goldman and we're speaking to Rob Hamill live on The English Breakfast here in Amsterdam. Morning, guys.
Hi.
G'day.
Hey, thank you very much for joining us on our IDFA special. That's International Documentary Film Festival Amsterdam. We've been talking about it for weeks because it really is one of the highlights in the Amsterdam calendar. And we're very privileged to be speaking to you guys. We have here the director and also the narrator and star of the documentary Brother Number One. And you're showing your documentary here at IDFA. It's an absolute pleasure to have you guys here on the show. Thank you very much for joining us. I hope you're both over your jet lag from NZ.
Just.
All right. So, Rob, do you want to give us just a quick... We've obviously put the synopsis up on our website, but do you want to give us a quick synopsis of the really powerful story that this documentary conveys?
Yeah, so it's basically following the journey of my brother, Kerry, and his adventures where he was doing his version of the OE, the Kiwi OE, was to sail the Seven Seas, and he'd been doing it for 9 to 12 months, and he was on his way to Bangkok taking a charter, blew off course into Cambodian waters, were taking shelter behind a small island that was no bigger than Rangitoto Island, actually, and on the other side of the island was a Khmer Rouge naval gun base, and that night they were attacked, and Kerry's friend Stuart Glass was shot and killed at that time, and the chartered John Dewhurst, an Englishman, along with my brother, were taken prisoner back to Torsling Prison, where they were tortured for a couple of months, forced to sign confessions that they were CIA, and were then executed.
Wow.
It was pretty horrific. And, you know, my parent, Kerry, just pretty much went missing. He'd been a regular letter writer, and they stopped, and and then the search went on for about 16 months before we found out what had happened.
Wow. Okay. That's pretty powerful stuff. And Annie, what drew you to actually, come to tell this story?
Well, I think it was an interesting international and regional story. I mean, I was pretty aware of the Khmer Rouge regime, and I'd been living in New York City when the photographs from Torsling Prison were exhibited, which were images of people who were then gone on and tortured and killed. So I was pretty aware, and I was always aware too that really Cambodia had not had the kind of attention it should have. So, and then it seemed with this Kiwi connection, we had a couple of Kiwi connections, not only Rob's story, but also the fact that Sylvia Cartwright, one of our esteemed judges, Dame Sylvia Cartwright, was actually sitting on the tribunal of a war crimes tribunal that has been brought together finally after 31 years to try former members of the Khmer Rouge. So really, with the film, we follow Rob, who not only, we don't just explore Kerry's fate, but we travel with Rob to Cambodia, to Phnom Penh, where he gives a statement to the War Crimes Tribunal as something called a civil party, which means people that tell how the atrocities impacted on their family and their personal lives. So that's the kind of narrative arc. So we travel with Rob to Cambodia, and it's the first time you'd been there, wasn't it? So it's quite a powerful sense of discovery for you.
Yeah.
So what was it like for you personally, Rob? I mean, obviously this all took place, I believe, in 1978, is that right?
Yeah.
And then I guess we're talking 33 years later. What was it like having to revisit those old emotions for you?
Yes, well, it was the day of landing in the and you'll see, I understand you're going to see the film tomorrow night, but I had a fairly emotional arrival. It was, I was very surprised at that. I mean, I was very anxious about arriving there in the first case, of course, but I ended up having a bit of a, I don't know, it was just a very weird scene that 31 years later, almost to the day that I landed on Cambodian soil, that my brother had been there. And then, you know, I guess part of the thing with this whole thing was then going on to meet some of the perpetrators. And in fact, I met a guy who was, in fact, who was an interrogator/torturer. And I'm pretty sure he played a role in the treatment of my brother directly. And not that he admitted to that. But and that was pretty challenging, I think. You know, I was having to deal with a few emotions there. And some of the characters beyond that, to some of the leaders we meet along the way. Again, you know, I think one of our objectives was to not get, to remain calm and to remain respectful to these people, because we wanted to get as much information as we could and not respond as you preps would like to respond.
Yeah.
And they'd just shut down and not get any information out of them.
Okay. Yeah. I can't imagine what it must have been like, but does going there to offer that victim statement and then making a story about it to communicate that to the world, does it tick some boxes? Does it close some, does it help you to get to a better place with this horrendous story?
Mm. Yeah, it's a common theme that you go through all this angst and, emotion and recognizing, you know, the big thing is, do I really want to know what happened to my brother, for example? Mm. Is that going to be helpful?
Yeah.
And initially I was really apprehensive about that, but the more I went into it, the more I did want to know. And and I guess the view is that, why shouldn't I know? I mean, my brother actually had it happen to him. You know, that's to actually know is actually what happened to him is actually very minor compared to actually, I guess it's just more lingering, I suppose. In terms of whether it's been good or bad, I think it's been absolutely for our grieving process. And I think you see the country, the Cambodian people, haven't had a chance to talk about this at all. And this court has been fantastic to get people. You know, there's this sort of underlying, oh, no, let's just let it go. It's in the past. Yeah. You know, let's just forget about it. But you give these Cambodian people a microphone in a public forum and they are yelling in it. They're screaming their anger. This happened to my family, to my father, my brother, my sister, my son. And it's a very powerful, and you see this exhibited time and time again. And that's got to be, to discuss it, to get it out there. And now there's, for the first time too, in the last 2 years, finally there's some education going back into the people as a result, to the schools. You know, kids just don't know.
No, I mean, that's what happened, really. Your listeners probably understand that 2 million Cambodians were killed through that 3.5-year period. But really, because of kind of the messy post-Cold War aftermath, kill all your intellectuals, close all your schools, destroy all universities, all your law institutions, rewrite history. And it's pretty hard for and then keep a minor civil war going. It's very hard for kind of the truth to come out. So many Cambodians had to live side by side, perpetrators. And it was just, I just think their grief and suffering was enormous and continues to be.
Mm. Has there been a big reaction from sort of the Cambodian people to the story?
We did work closely with a few Cambodian people, with survivors, and also in particular we make one of our very charismatic translators and line producers a character herself, so her story unfolds next to Rob's own. We haven't shown it widely in Cambodia yet. We need to do a Khmer version so it's more accessible to more people. And actually, the court is pretty shaky too. It's politically quite volatile. There has been government interference, corruption, or allegations of corruption. So the whole thing has been a bit of a joyride in that regard too, hasn't it? So we want to step reasonably carefully.
Okay. Now, Julian, you obviously saw it earlier this week. What was your reaction, man on the street?
Well, I thought it was a very, I mentioned it in an email to you, Mike, I thought it was quite a harrowing story. I am at least partially familiar with the story before I went, because I've travelled to Cambodia and I also used to study a little bit of this university about genocide and that sort of thing. So I was aware of the bare bones, but it's never really been brought home to me in a really human way. I think often cross-culturally it's harder to identify with people, the Cambodian people, about how much suffering has actually occurred there. But then I guess you get someone from a similar cultural background, and Rob's the protagonist here, where he takes us through his own and his family's journey. What really struck me was, I guess, your magnanimity in saying, you know, it's not just about me, it's also about this, and it's about what's happened to this beautiful country with beautiful people. And even though all the awful things that have gone on and all the people that are still sort of at loose and haven't been brought to justice, they are still suffering, and this is one of the ways in this whole edifice of criminal tribunals, war tribunals, trying to help heal the divisions in the country, and I think that's only a good thing. But in terms of the documentary, I thought it was really well put together. I thought it was a good length. I thought it was well paced, and I thought it really captured the pain of yourself, Rob, and also more generally the country, and on this sort of cathartic journey to a resolution.
You know, I'd like to think it is a very sad story, obviously, but there's so many messages that can come from that actually really positive messages, and it's the one you've talked about, the grieving process, and I think many of us don't do the death thing very well. Mm. And Māori culture has been particularly very good at acknowledging ancestors, etc. But the other thing, I think it's very inspiring. I mean, what my brother did, as you'll discover if you go along, you know, tomorrow night, was it totally inspiring the way he dealt with his incarceration there in this hellhole, and when he had to, you know, write this confession of being CIA. And he puts it into a context that I think people can go, yeah, absurd this is. And he uses humour to good effect. Mm. And yet he's tormented, you know. He is there, and we're just watching it, but we're able to see this incredibly inspiring response, I think, and without going into too much detail.
Wouldn't want to spoil the story.
All right, well, listen, it's 21 past 8. We're going to go to a track, and then we're going to come back and continue this, because, I don't know, I'm fascinated. Heavy stuff for this morning, but, you know, we're tackling the big issues here on The English Breakfast. The time is 8:21. We're going to go to a little bit of Boulder Space. This is Splat. Going to come back. We're speaking to director Annie Goldman and protagonist Rob Hamill here on The English Breakfast. Kui moraka. All right, the time is 24 past 8. You're listening to The English Breakfast on our International Documentary Film Festival Amsterdam special. And we are speaking to the director and protagonist from documentary entitled Brother Number One. They're live here in the studio. We have Annie Goldman and Rob Hamill. Morning again, guys. Thanks again for coming in.
Hi.
It's a pleasure to have you here on the studio. Now, obviously, Sunday you have some questions that you want to probe Rob on.
Yeah. So I haven't seen the documentary yet. I will do so tomorrow. I was just wondering, you know, you were a teenager when your brother went missing, right? And we all have different ways of dealing with grief or finding closure. And I just was wondering, what happened in your family with your parents, you? Did you guys talk about it? Were you all in shock? And then you just said that, you know, you went to Cambodia for the documentary, and then you found answers. And didn't you want to find these answers earlier in your life? And how does it work? I was just wondering.
Yeah, gosh, there's a whole layer of things there. The way it affected us, I mean, first of all, of course, the initial concern and then hope. And I think that hope dragging out for 16 months, and then the ultimate terrible news affected my parents. You know, I mean, I can't possibly understand how they were affected by it, because it's never happened to me in that sense, having a child be taken in that way. And for mum, no, they there was no support systems there. Social services back then were very limited. And so really, they just went into their shells. They were very strong for us, for the kids, the three remaining, four remaining kids at that time. For me personally, I ended up getting it on the booze. Mm-hmm. I kind of went into my teenage shell a bit more than probably what I would normally have. I don't know, really. It's hard to say, you know, how that affected me. I probably would have. But I used to go out every night, you know, during my fifth form year. I remember my fifth and sixth form years at school.
Yeah.
And Monday to Sunday, or Monday to Saturday night, anyway, I would be out late on the booze, drinking huge amounts of alcohol. And I don't know how, and drink driving and terrible things. And you know, how I got through that, I don't know. But actually, sport, I do know. Actually, sport really was my saviour. Yeah. And I got into volleyball in a big way at that time at school, in my school years. And my friends had a couple of very good, one in particular, a very close friend who we just, Yeah, we hung out a lot. That saved me, really.
Did you ever feel that you were able to, as we, you know, we say in Dutch, to give it a spot, you know, a place in life, or is it right now that you feel more closure? Were you ever able to accept this, or was it an ever lingering on thing?
Oh, it was very much a lingering thing.
Yeah.
And you know, but it didn't really, wasn't really driven home how much it was lingering, how much is hanging around in my life in the background, until I did the Atlantic rowing race in 97. And it was that time when, under the extreme duress, you know, sleep deprived, physically exhausted, and it brought all the stuff to the surface. And I ended up grieving a lot at sea, mm-hmm. for my brother, and I thought, I'm going to have to do something. How that would look, I didn't know, but yeah.
And then this documentary, was it a result of the trial, or were you already going to the trial, and then you guys decided to do the documentary?
Mm.
How did that go?
Well, it sort of came together through a third party initially. Rob had been working with another guy, and I sort of came on board a bit later. But it sort of seemed, I mean, Rob's journey was one thing and a very important thing, but to enhance the journey with the potential educational outreach impact seemed I hate to use that term, no-brainer, but it sort of was. It seemed to be a really good idea. And plus, you know, as a filmmaker, I immediately, which is a really important, and might sound a bit strange, but I really recognised it would be fundable.
Mm-hmm.
It has a New Zealander at its core. It would satisfy our funding organisations' requirements. So it was relatively easy to get funding for it as well.
Yes.
So, I mean, documentary makers have lots of great ideas that just sort of stay on the shelf because they're not timely, but this struck me as really timely.
Mm-hmm. So these interviews that you did with the, so let's say, perpetrators, they were a result of the documentary. You didn't plan to do those yourself.
No, I wouldn't have done those. No, uh-huh. No way.
And
so
was,
that created a great opportunity.
Yeah. Was there ever at one moment that you thought, I'm not going to do it after all? No, this is it's going to be too much?
No, I'm usually, once I make a decision, I usually
get
stuck into it and try and rise above whatever challenges you know are thrown at me.
But it's for me it's unimaginable. It's unimaginable to actually talk to these people, knowing what they did to your brother, and obviously to all the victims.
Well, I have to say, you know, it wasn't necessarily unaffecting, because we, you know, and there were times where you could have said, "Oh, geez, let's get out of here," because I felt threatened. I felt, you know, life threatened at times. And one of the people we interviewed was the head of the Khmer Rouge Navy, who still has a foothold or as an advisor to the government today. And when we bowled up at his house, actually, just completely unannounced, and right up in the northwest part of Cambodia, which is still Khmer Rouge kind of country. And he was on his hammock, asleep in his undies, and we bowled up. And as far as we knew, he had never been filmed before on cameras, and very anxious. And we woke him up, and he pulled his pants on as we were talking to him, and we asked him for an interview, and he agreed, and we're going, yes, get the cameras, let's get going. And we were there for about 2 hours, and it was, you'll see in the film, he's
still a believer.
He's a believer.
Yeah. So when you talk to somebody like that, does he come across immediately as somebody who could have done that, or do you look at a person and do you think, you know, this is unimaginable?
Well, there's a nice exchange with Rob and the translator, and Rob, so that they have a little English aside while he's sort of sitting there. And she says he has a very nice face, a very gentle face, but you have to expect people not to tell the truth.
Yeah.
So, you know, it is confusing, actually, at times. You know, and all of your things like human empathy, I mean, certainly not him, but some of the younger, the people that we interviewed, perpetrators, would have been boys when they were recruited.
Yes.
And there is a whole class context, the bombing by the U.S., the whole post-Vietnam aftermath that we try to explore in the film too, so it's contextualized. I mean, some of these people were not born evil, you know, they were kind of recruited out of a set of circumstances.
Has the film been shown back home yet?
Yes, to great acclaim and wonderful reviews in the New Zealand Film Festival.
Okay, so fantastic.
Yeah.
Amazing response.
Nice.
So Rob and I did the kind of country.
Yeah.
Up and down the islands.
Okay, and with the screening here that was on Thursday, were there any tough director Q&As at the end?
Well, yesterday, we've had two screenings. Yesterday, I actually wasn't meant to be an official Q&A. They say you're allowed two Q&As out of three screenings. So yesterday wasn't an official one. Mm. So I shot through because I was feeling a bit tired before the end of the film, but Rob did an informal Q&A.
Yeah, it was amazing. Actually, yeah. At the end of the film last night, we're nearly midnight, and the credits rolled and the lights came up and everyone stayed sitting, and I stood up and looked back and was like, should we do a Q&A? And they all sat there, and it was amazing. It was extraordinary, actually.
Okay. Yeah, okay, fantastic. And what else have you got? Have you got anything else planned for while you're over in Europe?
No, I sort of got to get back on a plane on early Sunday morning. Our last screening, as you know, is on Saturday. And I also teach at the University of Auckland.
Okay, right, got to get back.
Film studies. Yeah. And so I have a heap of bureaucracy and marking on my desk to wade my way through.
Okay, lovely.
Well, I've got 2 days, and you guys, somebody out there may want to give me some direction on what I should do. I was thinking about hiring a bike today, actually.
Absolutely. Do you play touch?
Hmm.
Game of touch?
Do you row?
Do you row, bro?
You, bro.
All right, so and how are you getting back, Rob? Are you rowing home, or how does it work?
You jump in the big bird, the big silver bird.
Economy class. That's all right. The way.
Exactly. Yeah. So you'll find out, Sunday. I'm not sure if this came across in the synopsis, but Rob was a famous transatlantic rower, just decided to row the Atlantic just for fun back in 90. Was it 97?
Yeah. 97.
Wow. Well, no. It seems
a long time ago.
Yeah, it is quite a long time ago, but it seems like just yesterday, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, it does in some ways. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's very.
Have you got any big projects sort of like that coming up?
Oh, look, the Kiwis and Aussies listening, you've got to tune into this. This is great. We've got a row happening. It's leaving this Sunday. I should be there right now. I've worked on it for about 8 years and I had to be here. But teamgallagher.co.nz.
Okay.
We've got a crew of four going to row across from Sydney Harbour Bridge to Auckland Harbour Bridge.
Wow.
And it's cool, mate. You see the boat. It's totally sexy. It's on the website. It's Facebook as well.
Team
Gallagher and or Gallagher, whatever you... And it's and you can tune in every day. These guys are going to do video clips, going to upload to the web. And
did you say? It's a team of how many?
Four crew.
Okay, right.
And
nice.
An interesting side story is Sir Peter Blake's son is one of the rowers, James.
Wow, nice.
It's a lovely story, and he's a great kid. And so it's all, yeah, oh, we're on the website now. Good on you, Jordan.
Okay, yeah. Fantastic. That's teamgallagher.co.nz. I've always wondered, is it harder physically to canoe or to kayak or to row?
Oh, kayaks for sissies.
Really? Yeah. Okay. So it's always harder to row. Nice one. Well, guys, thank you very much for joining us here on the show. Really, really great to hear the story. Really great to hear about the documentary. Feel free to stick around. The show's on for another 20 minutes, so please stick around if you're not in any hurry. You'll hear all about what's happening in Amsterdam this weekend. But the main thing happening is at Tuschinski 3 tomorrow at 4:15. You can come and see Brother Number One. I think there's still a few tickets available, so get along, see this amazing story, and you might have a chance for some Q&A with the protagonist and the director, right?
Cool.
Nice one. All right. Yeah. You're at the English Breakfast. The time is 8:35. We're going to go to another Kiwi classic. Here's a bit of Dominion Road from the Halfway House. This is the Mutton Birds.